proceed to the fourth case, Matson versus Caterpillar. Ms. Trafton.
May it please the court, Catherine Trafton for Thomas Matson, the appellant. In this case, the district court found that Mr. Matson was fired for filing a false charge of sexual harassment with the Illinois Department of Human Rights and the EEOC after he had been previously warned by Caterpillar that such conduct would lead to discipline, including discharge. Even though the district court found that Matson was fired in direct response for his filing the charge, it found that Caterpillar was privileged to do so because it had a good faith belief that his charge was false.
Well, I mean, actually, this goes further than that. I was a little staggered at the breadth of your argument that no matter how knowingly false a charge is that's filed with IDHR, it's absolutely protected under the retaliation part of the statute. That's not the law in a lot of other areas. For example, there's not even First Amendment protection for knowingly filing false forecasts of production with administrative agencies. I'm thinking of the Woods Exploration case. It's not protected if you knowingly file false or sham lawsuits against people. This isn't a big area, but it's an important area where it applies. And it seems to me that knowingly filing false charges goes quite a step beyond being mistaken. It goes quite a step beyond being malicious. It goes quite a step beyond most of these other cases. Whether or not the Supreme Court's recent decisions cover, you know, opposition conduct or other kinds of conduct, I'm very uncomfortable with the idea that we're going to give absolute protection to people to abuse process in this way.
I don't want to confuse the court. My argument is not that someone can make a perjurious argument to the administrative agency.
How about knowingly false? You know, anyone who thinks, let's say, that looking at someone from across the room amount one time on one occasion, I'm deliberately changing the facts here a little bit, amounts to sexual harassment is ridiculous, given the Supreme Court's case law, our case law, all common sense. And if that person files a charge not for the purpose of raising a concern about sexual harassment, but in an effort to get the alleged harasser fired, that's an abusive process.
Well, and I think that there would be other mechanisms for dealing with that abusive process, and I think that the agency would be in a good position to deal with an individual who was abusing the process of the agency.
No, what would the agency do?
I don't know. I'm not familiar enough with the EEOC's specific processes for dealing with that, but I suspect that if they were under the impression that an employee was continually filing false or essentially lying to the agency, that they would have ways to address that.
Like what?
Perjury.
What? You mean they would refer him to the Justice Department for prosecution?
I suspect that they would not have to go that far. I suspect that they could have a conversation.
Could they bar him from further filing?
I don't believe the agency would have the authority to file.
So what could they do?
To bar him from.
What could they do except turn him over to some prosecutorial authority?
Well, they would dismiss his charge, and
I think... Yes, of course. But what else?
And I think that they would educate him about...
Oh, please.
Well, I understand the court's concern that...
That's preposterous. Was it in your brief you also suggested maybe she could sue him for defamation?
The Fifth Circuit in the Petway decision...
Well, that's absurd also, right? You don't sue a person like this for defamation. He didn't have any money.
Well, that the employer.
Unless you're going to pay his defamation bill, the union.
Well, I certainly understand the court's concern that taking this situation to its extreme pushes the limits of what seems...
Well, apparently, since you're a union person, you know, for example, that the Labor Board, that the National Labor Relations Act privileges collective, concerted activity in, you know, support of better working conditions on, right?
Yes.
But concerted activity doesn't include agreeing to smash the employer's equipment, right?
Right. That would, if
right? It
yes.
doesn't include, yeah, right. But that's not in the Act.
Well, what I would argue is that all of the courts...
So your argument based on, you know, there's no explicit exception, mm-hmm. Is not consistent with the way parallel issues under labor law are approached.
My argument is that in order to protect the integrity of the administrative process here, there has to be a bright line rule. And that bright line has to be that once an employee invokes
the process... Yeah, but the bright line can be that if, as Judge Wood said, if the charge is knowingly false, defamatory, and deliberately defamatory, then it's not protected, and that's a bright line.
Well, and more than that, such a rule would be quite consistent with the law in so many other areas. And I might add, you know, particularly if it was brought not for the purpose of actually obtaining relief, but for the purpose of, you know, getting somebody else fired or, you know, some action that has nothing to do with the ostensible purpose of the complaint.
I understand what Your Honor is saying, and I think that there are different places where the line could be drawn. And I think I would like, at this point, just to draw back to the record here just to make the point that there is no allegation of defamation here. There is no allegation by Caterpillar that Mr. Mattson defamed
no,
his employer.
No, but the defamation isn't the problem here. Mr. Hollis's affidavit and testimony and the other information gathered during not just the one but the two investigations of Mr. Mattson revealed that Mr. Mattson didn't even know whether this touching was on purpose or inadvertent, that it only happened once, that he did it because he was determined to get Ms. Cohn out of there no matter how, no matter what mechanism he needed. So he basically, they have evidence in front of them that this is a completely false claim, that this claim is not being brought for any legitimate reason.
But interestingly, that's the same evidence they had in front of them when
not Mr. Hollis. They didn't collect Mr. Hollis's affidavit, which was the final piece of information, until after the second investigation prompted by the IDHR filing occurred.
Right, but if you look at the conclusions of the investigator who did the first investigation...
It makes every difference in the world, though, to have more evidence, to have... You know, first you might just suspect something, but when somebody actually comes forward and gives you evidence, you're in a different position.
But this, they would not have been in this position were it not for the fact that he went to the IDHR and filed his charge. As far as they were concerned, this file was closed. The only thing that triggered their going back and opening it up and getting this affidavit from Mr. Hollis was that he had filed the charge.
Why does that matter? Now they find out that when he initially... was raising these complaints, it was in complete bad faith. They find out essentially that he's lying about what happened, and employers generally think they can terminate the employment of somebody who lies.
The reason that is wrong is because the statute specifically says that once an employee participates in the process by filing a charge, he's protected.
That's where I'm having problem with your position, because you are taking the position that this includes lies as protected conduct, and I have a big problem with thinking that the law protects knowing falsehood.
Actually, what I'm arguing is not that it protects lies, but that it protects the employee so that the person who makes the decision...
It doesn't protect lies, are you saying?
I am. The argument can be... I will take the argument to that point, but if I could, what my
but
argument
it does protect lies, that you can lie to your heart's content to IDHR or EEOC, and as long as you file the charge beforehand, you're completely protected?
Yes, that is the argument I'm making.
Okay.
And in addition, I would also like to say that
Really bad argument.
The policy argument here, what does
really
it happen?
Bad argument, because what it means is that you now arm workers by filing what amounts to malicious prosecution, by engaging in malicious prosecution, you give them a free shot at getting rid of supervisors they don't like or subordinates they don't like. Or
the process will.
Why are you doing this? I don't understand you.
The reason I'm doing it is
the union. This is not in the union's interest.
The policy here, and if I may just explain, the policy here that's being protected is that when an employee goes to the agency, they have the right to have the agency make the determination about whether they are lying, whether their charge is brought in good or bad faith.
But of course, that's entirely contrary to how our... you don't say, for example, if you're a lawyer, I hope you don't do this, I hope you don't say to your witnesses when you're preparing them for testimony, if you want to lie, you want to perjure yourself, go ahead, it's for the judge or the jury to decide the case. So you can say anything you want.
No, of course not, Your
Honor.
You
can make false statements on the witness stand. You can make false statements to a government agency.
No,
that's what you just said. You can lie to the EEOC because it's their business to sift truth from falsehood.
Well, the employer, under the mechanism set up by the statute here,
if one of your union workers comes to you and says, look, I'd like to get rid of this employer, I'd like to get rid of this supervisor, so I want to fabricate a charge. If I do that and I give this fabricated charge to the EEOC, am I protected against any kind of retaliation by the employer? And you would say yes.
I would explain what the law is. I would certainly not counsel anyone.
No, but he's not asking for counsel. He's asking whether
yes, and I would say
it's
the
okay.
Court,
and then you'll say, well, you know, employer can't do anything about this. So
what I would say is that the expansive nature of the anti-retaliation provision, as interpreted by various courts of appeals, has been so broad because of the policy interests at stake to protect.
But there is no policy interest when you have people testifying in court, and yet they aren't permitted to lie. Also, I wonder if it's right to characterize this as retaliation for filing the charge. Why isn't it simply retaliation for behaving in a completely unreasonable and manner, destructive to the discipline of the workforce? That is, the filing of the charge, that's just evidence that this is a completely unfit employee, Mr. Mattson. No employer wants to have a person who goes around spreading lies.
The reason that's the justification on the table here is because that's what Caterpillar has said. They have asserted that the reason they fired him was for him filing false charges of harassment.
I'm sure if your concern is a chill, obviously, on reporting bad behavior. What if we have a situation where in the course of an EEO sexual harassment investigation, there's evidence that the employee theft is involved. In other words, and that just comes about as a fact pattern. Were the employer not able to move against the employee who had been involved in theft? So it was just produced in the course of the investigation. Evidence turns out that he takes tools home at night or whatever. So that there's no question that we have, except that there's a theft. Would the employer not be able to act on that kind of information because of, for discharge purposes?
If they had no other independent
right.
evidence of that.
That's how they found out. I mean, in the course of a sexual harassment suit, the facts just bubbled up that this guy was also involved in employee theft. Wouldn't that be the kind of thing you want to find room for the employer to work, to act on?
I think that the statute would allow room there, Your Honor, because the statute protects someone because from retaliation because they filed a charge, testified, assisted, or participated. So it's their participation in the investigation that they cannot be retaliated against for. So I'm not sure that the use
Well, except for the EEOC investigation into the complaint, we would never know of the theft. I mean, in other words, in depositions, it becomes clear that whatever the merits of the harassment suit, we have an individual who regularly takes company property. There is no other way. It just never been focused on except for the fact that the harassment suit claim was made.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't want to preclude employer action there, would we? In the interest, wouldn't in balancing the policy, we got criminal act involved. Would we insulate that?
Mm-hmm. If thinking about it, off the top of my head, it does not seem that. The situation you're posing is what the participation clause intends to protect. I also think that in practical terms, an employer is very likely to have independent ways to acquire the evidence they need to establish.
Well, they may build on it, but the wellspring is the vignette about the harassment. In other words, it's in the course of all the dynamics that often surround these kinds of charges. Employee misconduct is found by the complaining individual. He turns out also to be a thief. I don't know, suggest that that's the normal case, but I'm just trying to take this to a point where we might want to narrowly tailor the sweep of the protection that you're arguing for.
Well, I would acknowledge that there probably are situations, and having not researched that point extensively, I don't know. There may be cases which have involved such a situation. It probably isn't so outlandish, quite frankly. But I do think that there, in that situation, it is different than what we have
here.
Well,
let's take the substance abuse situation, which is more likely to occur than theft. In the course of the reporting of the investigation, it turns out that the complaining witness is involved in abusing drugs or alcohol on the job.
Well, I wouldn't want to concede that that participation in a proceeding by testifying in a deposition, for instance, then opens up your employer to take various actions against you. The idea here is that once you engage in the statutory remedial process, then you are protected. And I think that an employer would have to have independent evidence to support something, to support taking an action against an employee based on information that they discovered in that situation.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Stratton. Mr. Warner?
Good morning. We do contend that the simple and straightforward way of affirming the court below is to hold that the plaintiff did not establish a prima facie case because he is not entitled to the retaliatory protection under Title VII because there is no reasonable basis, there no reasonable person could conclude that there is a harassment claim that would violate Title VII.
Are you arguing for an objective test, which you seem just to have articulated, no reasonable person could think that, or as part of the briefing in this case has suggested, is there a subjective element of bad faith that needs to be found, and who finds that? Is this a unilateral determination by the company, or is this something for later consideration?
Well, we think the case can be decided on either basis because there is, based on all the circumstances in this case, a bad faith filing of the charge, and the evidence was revealed as a result of the second investigation. And so in this case, and this is consistent with all jurisprudence, that where someone approaches with a false charge in bad faith, they should not be entitled to protection.
Well, if you look at something like, I grant you, from the antitrust field, Columbia Outdoor Advertising, there actually is a two-part. I mean, you have to show both for the kind of sham litigation that's so frivolous that it doesn't even get protection under the Norr-Pennington Doctrine. You have to show both that it's objectively baseless and that it's taken for improper motives.
Well, and we certainly take the position that on any objective basis, this is an unreasonable charge. And we feature that argument because we are not, in our view, writing on a clean slate. Even if we were writing on a clean slate, I think this, the plaintiff is not entitled to protection because we do have the...
You're arguing there's also bad faith. That's shown by the, what, Hollis's testimony? Or
yes, that it was done with a retaliatory motive, in bad faith, to try to get rid of Beth Cohen. In fact, if there's any EEO overriding issue here, it is the right of the company and the obligation of the company to protect the right of a female supervisor to supervise without being subjected to false claims by someone who simply wants to get rid of his supervisor. And that was the
That's
ultimate...
That's narrower than a no reasonable basis test.
That is correct, but if you also look at the facts, there could be no reasonable person could conclude that what the plaintiff alleges constitutes sexual harassment, in the same way that the Supreme Court in the Breeden case determined that no reasonable basis on the fact that there would be no reasonable basis on the facts of that case to conclude that the plaintiff was entitled to protection under the Act.
Well, is it an either or in your view, either no reasonable basis or an improper purpose? Either one would justify the company in firing the person.
I think either one would justify the company, and I think we have both here. For example, even without the Hollis affidavit, there is no reasonable basis given the admissions by the plaintiff.
You could have a reasonable basis, but nevertheless, the malicious intent, that would be like the difference between abusive mm-hmm. process and malicious prosecution, right? So suppose, in fact, there was, someone might have thought that Madsen was a victim of sexual harassment, but he doesn't think that. He doesn't care about that. He's not bothered by this. But he would like to get rid of her on extraneous grounds, so he files a claim that he, it could be thought reasonable, but his only motive in doing so is to remove a supervisor that he dislikes on unrelated grounds.
Well, as I understand your hypothetical, there would be an objectively reasonable basis
right.
for the charge.
Objectively, it's unreasonable. That's why I say either or.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah, I think if the evidence was undisputed that it was a bad motive, there could be a basis for summary judgment on that basis.
Why should motive make any difference if there's an objective basis for the charge? People every day have things happen to them that might justify filing a lawsuit, and sometimes they forego the possible suit because it costs money and it disrupts your life and so on. But maybe if the person who did it is somebody you hate anyway, you go ahead and file the charges. Now, you have a bad motive. You're trying to do it to aggravate them, but there's an objective basis for the suit. That wouldn't be enough in many areas to throw out the lawsuit.
I understand that, and I could envision that would also create disputes of fact as to
now, if he has no purpose if he has no interest in actually the EEOC doing anything, and has no interest in winning a judgment, all he wants to do is to get her removed. That would be abusive process. That's what abusive process is.
I believe that's true.
I think your argument is, you know, if it's abusive process, then that's improper also. I don't think. Doesn't seem to be necessary to decide that in this case, though.
That is correct. There are two alternative arguments, and certainly probably the simplest and more straightforward way is to take the cue from the Supreme Court in Breeden, which has already said if there is no reasonable person could believe this would constitute harassment, then on an objective test, which is certainly should apply here, he is not entitled to protection.
But your opponent argues that the context of Breeden perhaps can tolerate that better from the need to make sure that people aren't deterred from filing charges with the relevant authorities when they're in doubt. And if they're afraid that, you know, 20/20 hindsight will show that somebody thought it wasn't objective or what have you, there might be a reason not to follow that rule.
Well, let me suggest two reasons why I believe it's even more important to apply the Breeden rule in a formal charge filing process. First of all, view it from Beth Cohn's perspective. It's bad enough that she was subjected to an internal charge, but to be subjected to a formal governmental charge, and I've been through this many times in my career, people assume they're going to be personally liable no matter how many assurances you give them. They assume it's going to have an adverse impact upon their job. Secondly, by filing this unreasonably based charge, it triggers wasteful administrative procedures and judicial procedures. So it is even more important in that context to apply the Breeden rule to a formal charge than an internal charge. Now, they say the Breeden Court had the opportunity to make that ruling in the participation context, but the Breeden case did not have the same situation we had here. The second matter in that case was not the same sexual harassment charge. It was a retaliation charge. The court decided that issue on an alternative basis. But assume the Breeden Court had our situation. Internal false charge, same harassment allegation in the formal EEOC charge. Certainly the Supreme Court would apply the same rule to the formal charge that it applied to the informal internal charge. And therefore the Breeden Court and its progeny are direct authority to support applying the Breeden rule in this context to both the formal charge, It should be understood that we do not concede that the reason for the discharge was the filing of the IDHR charge. The reason for the discharge was when that triggered the other investigation, the Hollis affidavit was produced, new evidence. At that point, the company had the basis for sustaining a discharge through the union grievance and arbitration process.
I think the problem is there's an overlap here, because you can have a. I would think the situation would be that the filing of a malicious or unreasonable charge would provide information to an employer about this employee. So you might say, look, a person who does this crazy stuff, what's he going to do next? So you can imagine firing someone not because he filed the charge, but because of what the charge revealed about him and his propensity to cause other, might be quite unrelated, problems for the company. I think you're suggesting that because it's kind of reverse sexual harassment, right? He's trying to get rid of a female supervisor.
Sure.
Well, he can get the company in trouble in the future if he plays these games.
Well, and that could well be a motivation. I think the principal motivation here by the company taking discharge action is to protect the right of the supervisor to supervise without being subjected to false claims. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Warner. Mr. Chaffin, your time has expired, but you may have a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I could just make one point, and that is that even if this court is to read a good faith requirement or some requirement of a reasonable basis or something along those lines in this case, there was never a finding here of bad faith or of lying. The district court here found that the company had a good faith belief that the employee had filed a false charge. That's very different than saying Mattson had filed a bad faith charge. He has contested all along in this litigation that he filed his charge in good faith.
Even if what he said was true, why was he bothered? Why does he care?
Why was he uncomfortable with the supervisor's conduct?
Realistically, why would someone care about this?
That's a very difficult question for me to answer, Your Honor. I think that, you know, in these situations, it is incredibly important, you know, what the individual's perception of the behavior is. And Mr. Mattson has, you know, testified in good faith that he was uncomfortable with this conduct.
Well, maybe he was slightly uncomfortable. Why would that get anywhere close to harassment?
Especially when you consider this court's harassment cases, like Saxon, where people are leaping out from behind bushes and groping all over other people and so on, and we say, oh, that's just part of a day's work.
Certainly, we as lawyers would read this conduct very differently, but I think that's in fact exactly the point here. When an individual layperson, when a non-lawyer files a charge, they haven't read the cases of the Seventh Circuit or of any court necessarily, and they don't know what the standards of the law are. They know what they're
told White that he thought it was inadvertent. He said he had no idea whether she did it intentionally because the noise is so loud or in a suggestive manner, and that he didn't think Cohn was attracted to him.
That's
what he told Ms. White. Mm-hmm. In the record.
I think that he told her a variety of things about how this behavior made him feel, and I think that what I understand that comment to mean is that, you know, he wasn't going to necessarily read into her behavior, you know, a specific motive. He was saying that behavior makes me uncomfortable, and as I understand it, that's sexual harassment, and that's why he was complaining.
Are we permitted to be slightly realistic about the defense about the differences between men and women?
In how we interpret the anti-retaliation provision?
Women don't like to be brushed by men. But do you really think men have a symmetrical distress if they get brushed by a woman? Does that sound realistic, or we have to park any realistic insights into the difference between people when we judge cases?
Well, I think that the court...
There can be female sexual harassment. If a woman supervisor says to a man, you know, you have to have sex with me or you won't be promoted, that would be, of course, genuine sexual harassment. But brushing?
I understand what you're saying, Your Honor, and I understand that the court, if they were looking at a claim of sexual harassment, would have to deal with those difficult questions. But I don't think that that's an issue here. Mr. Mattson didn't have to understand the intricacies of sexual harassment law in the court when he filed his charge.
I understand, but if you put everything together, isn't the inference of bad faith overwhelming?
I do not believe that the inference of bad faith is overwhelming, Your Honor, no. Mr. Mattson has maintained throughout this litigation that he filed this charge in good faith.
Like he's an anchorite or a Taliban or something who's just very upset by the presence of women. He's an electrician. He's married. So someone brushes him. I don't get it. How could he think that was making his workplace situation unbearable? Because if you go down this route, you'll say, well, I felt uncomfortable because she was wearing makeup, and women with makeup make me uncomfortable because I have severe views of how women should deport themselves. Or she wasn't veiled, so I got upset because I'm Muslim. So is that all of this? You know, part of the. So there'd be no limit. Anytime you want to generate some colorable charge, you just make up some fantastic stuff about your own personal sensitivities.
Well, isn't the flip side of that, Your Honor, that an employer can, under the scheme that the district court has laid out, always assert, well, we had a good faith belief that this was a false charge, and that employee loses protection. I think that the slippery slope here is certainly on both sides. I hear the argument that you're making, but what's before us today is the question of whether an employer gets to decide when an employee has filed a charge with the EEOC, whether that charge was brought in good faith. And our argument here on appeal is that that's the decision of the agency, and that the statute protects that employee and allows him to have the determination about whether all of the, what you're laying out here in terms of the reasonableness of his charge, that the agency will make that determination.
Well, isn't it some protection, though, if the employer, I mean, this is a pretty low standard case, it looks like, on the facts, on harassment, but is an employer at risk if they choose to ratchet it up? I mean, you know, the employer is comfortable in this case, let's suggest. Won't it have to be facts pretty similar to this kind of situation before an employer would move?
I'm not sure I understand.
Well, if you retaliate, you're going to be subject possibly to all the penalties that will attend that in a courtroom setting.
Yes. So you're saying what option is left to the employer?
Right.
Well, I think that if the employee, so you're saying in this situation where an employee files a charge.
Well, let's take a little more practical approach. You know, my concern in any case is who's going to read the case beyond the litigants. And what signal it's going to send. Mm-hmm. So let's take an individual who is totally uncomfortable with women supervisors, and just sees it, reads it. What a great vehicle to chill employers advancing women, especially in blue collar settings, to supervisory capacity.
Well, isn't the employer here protected, or isn't the employee warned when they file their EEOC charge and they swear that what they are saying in that charge is true? Doesn't that protect you?
What's the penalty for that?
Well, presumably there's some, the agency would be able to, if they could prove that an employee was filing multiple false charges, you know, that perjury would be
cost of some sort. I mean, I don't know.
I guess what I'm trying to say is that I think that the court can offer broad protection under the retaliation provision without encouraging employees to lie, and I certainly understand that that's a concern, and I think that that can be done by emphasizing the point that you're not to bring false charges before the agency. Mr. Mattson did not bring a false charge before the agency.
In his view.
Yes.
In his view, and let's say we accept that. Mm-hmm. It's going to be awfully hard to prove that a charge is false off a setting like this, right?
Well, the employer thinks that they have.
Well, I understand that, but factually, have you ever seen in your experience this, a case more modest in support of one's reasonable belief that they've been harassed?
Can you think
of any case, any that you would cite to us factually to make us feel more comfortable that this conduct is reasonable on behalf and behalf of Max?
I'm not sure that I can't cite you to another.
I meant it somewhat rhetorically because I think it's pretty difficult, and I would suggest it's probably the view of the court that the facts are pretty light.
And I think that emphasizes, though, the difficulty here of allowing an employer to make those determinations.
If you were unsuccessful in this case, do you believe this would chill individuals from bringing sexual harassment to?
I do, Your Honor, and the reason that I do is because my experience is that employers would be very happy to see a decision like that and would be very happy to let their employees know.
An employer wouldn't read the facts of this case and say, gee, this is a pretty unique case as far as the facts go?
I think some employers would, absolutely, but I think there are some employers who would be very happy to receive such a decision and to be able to use it in their workplace to discourage employees and make sure that they understood that.
And then they'd lose the next round of retaliation cases. That's the thing. If these rather rigorous standards weren't met, they would do whatever they wanted to do, thinking that they were safe, and they'd get sued for retaliation, and they'd lose.
But our point is that they wouldn't lose because the claims wouldn't be brought, because the employees would be chilled with this belief that, you know, well, gosh, if I go forward with this, I might get fired. And I'm not entirely sure. I'm not a lawyer, and I can't afford to ask a lawyer if this is harassment. That's our point. The point is that the claims wouldn't be brought and that we would see a reduction in employees coming forward, and that that would be in direct contravention of the retaliation.
There might be a lot fewer women supervisors in generally male settings if the case were to indicate how modest a charge you can file against a woman supervisor.
I hope that would not be the case.
I would hope so, too. I mean, so there are sort of, if not competing policy considerations, challenging ones.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Warren. The case is taken under advisement.